Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we'll discuss the needs of the LGBTQIA plus community as they grow older. We'll be joined by Susan DeMoris, Director of the California Department of Aging, and Kathleen Sullivan, Executive Director of Open House, a center serving LGBTQ seniors here in the Bay Area. And then we're also going to meet Allegra Madsen, the new Executive Director of the Frameline Film Festival here in San Francisco. But first up, the Berkeley City Council recently reached a landmark agreement to transfer ownership of a sacred Ohlone site permanently back to Indigenous peoples here in the Bay after years of litigation and community outcry. Joining us to discuss is Karina Gould, the Ohlone leader who spearheaded the effort to return the land. Karina is here to help us understand why this agreement is so important and what happens next. So welcome to State of the Bay, Karina.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're glad you can join us. So first, I just wanted to ask if you can just give us some background on the site. Where is it and why is it sacred to the Ohlone people?
Well, thank you so much. That's a big question to begin with. if we can imagine the Bay Area before other people came here and made this their home, there were hundreds and hundreds of shell mounds that ring the entire Bay Area. In 1909, Anels Nelson from UC Berkeley mapped over 425 of them. The West Berkeley Shell Mound is on 4th and University and is the oldest of all 425 that ring the Bay Area. It's a part of our cosmology stories. They weren't just burial sites. Shell mounds were also a part of active village sites that were much bigger than the 2.2 acres of land that we were able to save. This particular site was also the site that we first buried our ancestors along the bay. It aligns with our sacred stories. One that we all know in the San Francisco Bay Area around different places that are normalized, right? Alcatraz mm-hmm. Island, this particular shell mound aligns with Alcatraz Island. It was an island that our ancestors never went to, but we believe our spirits went and sat there for 4 days while we had ceremony on the bay. And at the end of the day, of the fourth day, as the sun is setting, we believe our spirit leave through the Western Gate where the Golden Gate Bridge is today. And so this is a very important site for our people, the Lashon people on the East Bay, to protect and preserve. And we've been trying to protect and preserve this site for decades now. And we were just recently called into court over the last 6 years to deal with the final freeing of this land. Mm-hmm.
And Karina, you mentioned shell mound and that there's sometimes burials in shell mounds, but other things as well. Can you just describe what a shell mound is? It sounds like a place where, you know, if they're eating, the ancestors are eating shellfish, they're going to discard it there. But what else is in a shell mound and is there a definition of one?
Yeah, so I think that we first need to get rid of the idea of that archaeologists brought here from Europe, the idea of garbage heaps or dumps or mittens that were brought here. We would not throw our ancestors away in trash heaps with their cemeteries. And just like we have cemeteries all over the world, our ancestors were buried right in our village sites. Shells were not just the food for us, but they were a form of trade and of cultural significance. We used them for the first money that was here in the East Bay. And so they were really a source of sustenance in many different spiritual aspects, as well as sustaining us. And, you know, we could eat as many shellfish as we wanted to many years ago. And now because the bay is polluted, we can't do that. But we would bury our ancestors in layers of soil and rock and shell. And over thousands of years, these mounds became large. The one at the West Berkeley Shell Mound was 20 feet high. The one in Emeryville was over 3 stories high. These are man-made structures that honored the ancestors of our people.
And Karina, can you give us some history of this specific site and what the battle was about it? What was proposed on the site and what was that process like?
Yeah, sure. So Spanger's, many people in the Bay Area probably ate at Spanger's Fish Grotto, and the Spanger family came and they squatted that land, and they received that land for free. And they were fishermen when they came here, and they created a grotto. And if you can imagine that the Strawberry Creek ran right through their grotto and crossed that land that's across from there, that looks like a parking lot right now. And for decades, people from all over the world probably went there and ate. Lots of UC students went there and ate, and their families. But there's a new developer that was a part owner in the land, Dana Ellsworth and Rugen Ells. And some years ago in 2015 or 2016, they proposed a development on that land that would expand 4th Street, which is a shopping destination in the Bay, to include big box shopping and condominiums. And we found out about it. We were someone on the zoning board, Sophie Hahn, who's now a city council member, said, hey, I think this is a sacred site, because the city of Berkeley had actually landmarked it in 2020 as a significant site, a historic site that was supposed to be protected. We came to that meeting and we spoke up against that development. And then we organized community members from all walks of life in the Bay, and they came to zoning board meetings and spoke against the development and the protection of the sacred site. The draft EIR went out, and we had over 1,800 community members write on behalf of preserving the site. And the developers at that time and the decided to back out of that project. And a new law was created, a law that Senator Scott Wiener put forward, SB 35, that allowed for developments that were half affordable housing to get permitted, to go without CEQA, without public commenting. And they even left out the possibility of Native people to have a say over their sacred site. The city of Berkeley said no to the SB 35 project twice, and then was sued by the developer and the tribe, the Confederated Villages of Lashon Nation, who I am the tribal chair for. We intervened on that beside of the city of Berkeley and fought the developer. We won in lower court, and the judge likened the shell mound and village site to many ruined sites around the world. It went into appeals court during COVID. And while we were on Zoom in appeals court, the developer put up an 8-foot fence with barbed wire over the top of it, stopping us from actually having access to that land. But for years before COVID, we had thousands of people from all walks of life in the Bay come and pray with us and chant with us and dance and send out letters and information. We created a vision that you can see on shellmound.org of something that we would like to see on that site. And to really bring those ancestors that had been removed from that burial site back to be reinterred there, to reimagine opening up Strawberry Creek along that land again.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're speaking with Karina Gould, who is the Ohlone leader who spearheaded the effort to reclaim a ancestral sacred site back from a place that was slated for development. So, Karina, I want to talk about your organization, Segorite Land Trust, which is, as I understand it, a women-led organization that works to return indigenous lands. Can you talk about your organization and how it played a part in what happened with this parcel?
Yeah, so it's important to say that Segorite Land Trust is an urban indigenous women-led land trust. Not just a women-led land trust, but the urban indigenous-led land trust. And actually, Janella LaRose and I are the co-founders of that organization, and we actually started this work decades ago around preserving and protecting sacred sites of my ancestors in the Bay Area. We did lots of education, including walks from Vallejo down to San Jose and up to San Francisco, stopping at many of the shell mounds that have been destroyed. It was because of this work that we realized that that there was a need for us to have land returned back into indigenous hands. And our tribal area. I'm the tribal chair for the Confederated Villages of Lashon Nation, which is on the East Bay, what many people know as the generic term Ohlone. And we actually, our tribal territory is 5 Bay Area counties. But we had become homeless in our own homeland. And as we were trying to figure out how to bring these ancestors home from many of these institutions, we realized that we didn't have any place to put them. UC Berkeley holds 9,000 of just our ancestral remains. And you can imagine having to ask for them back and rebury them. Where would we do that if we had no land? And so we got into this work of creating a land trust as a way of bringing land back, using it as a tool to do that. And we are a group of, we are an organization that now employs 26 people. We have 10 different sites that we are taking care of in our traditional homelands. And Segorite has been the holder of title deeds and leases and for the lands that we are getting returned while employing young indigenous people to reengage with the land. And the tribe then gets to be cultural easement holders onto that land. And so returning land to the tribe in perpetuity.
And we just have a couple minutes left, but I really want to hear the story then of how the deal came together for the land trust to take this land back. And what are the terms of this deal?
Well, it's amazing that the city of Berkeley has become such huge partners with the Segorite Land Trust and the tribe. And it came down to the end of the court cases. At the beginning of the month, the developer decided that they wanted to go into a settlement. And so we went into settlement on March 8th. And it was determined that they would do a global settlement of damages and the property for the price of $27 million. Segorite Land Trust has used this idea of having good guests on our land and asking for people that work, live, and play here to pay shumi. Katali Foundation was one of the huge instrumental partners that gave $20 million in shumi. And it helped us to pay forward purchasing back our sacred site. We were also able in the last moment to get funding from the 11th Hour Foundation and from Jacob Pitzker in order to pull the deal forward. And the city of Berkeley is covering the last $1.5 million for a total of $27 million. It's been a great fight for over 6 years with thousands of people involved with it. But at the end of the day, the city of Berkeley agreed to an ordinance unanimously to purchase back the land and then return the land to Segorite Land Trust.
And Karina, just real briefly, what's the vision now for the site now that's going to be under the stewardship of the Segorite Land Trust?
Oh, we want to breathe first, of course, you know, and have a celebration of all the people that have been involved over all of these years. And then, you know, if people want to go to shellmound.org, that's the first vision that we have. And our friend Chris Walker helped us to develop that vision where we hope to have it as open space where we could open up the creek again, talk about the history and the resiliency of the Lashon people.
Well, it's a wonderful story. Karina Gold with the Segorite Land Trust, thank you so much for coming on State of the Bay and telling us about the saga, and congratulations on the win and the ability to get that land back.
Thank you so much.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we're going to talk to Susan DeMorris, Director of the California Department of Aging, and Kathleen Sullivan, Executive Director of Open House, a center serving LGBTQ seniors in the Bay Area. That's right after the break, so stay with us.
Tune in to Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We hear what it feels like to return home after spending time in prison.
There are the kind of mundane challenges that a returned citizen faces. And those challenges I was prepared for because I had set a plan, a course of action for my success.
A special episode of Uncuffed featuring stories of re-entry. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your fellow music traveler. Join me weeknights from 8 to 10 p.m. as we cross genres, generations, and go all across the musical map, discovering forgotten favorites, future favorites, and all the journeys in between. That's Monday through Friday nights, 8 to 10 p.m., right here on 91.7 KALW and KALW.org. Join us for the ride.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. We want you to be a part of this next conversation. We're going to be talking about a California survey designed to help address the needs of the LGBTQIA plus community as they age. And if you're an aging member of that community, what struggles have you had? What services or support would you like to see? Are there resources that have helped you as you've grown older? We really would love to hear from you. You can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also contact us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So in January of this year, the California Department of Aging launched an online survey for older LGBTQIA plus adults, conducted in partnership with local organizations, universities, and some other research partners. Its purpose is to gather information about that community's needs and priorities in order to better serve them. And while cities like San Francisco have administered surveys like this in the past, this is the first statewide survey. So here tonight to discuss the unique challenges faced by this community as they age and how the survey might help to address some of those challenges, I'm very pleased to be joined by Susan DeMorris, Director of the California Department of Aging. Welcome to State of the Bay, Susan.
Thank you, Ethan, and thanks for the invitation. I'm just so delighted to be here and to talk about the statewide survey that's underway until March 31st. So this is our final push this week.
Well, we have a lot to cover. I want to hear more about that, but very glad you can join. And we're also pleased to be joined by Kathleen Sullivan, Executive Director of Open House, a center serving LGBTQ seniors here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Thank you for joining us, Kathleen.
Thank you, Ethan. It's nice to be here.
So, Susan, I wanted to start with you. Can you give us a little bit of background on the survey? What led your department to put it out in the first place?
Sure. Well, actually, one of the proponents of the survey is joining me tonight, Kathleen Sullivan at Open House. A key part of the governor's master plan for aging is stakeholder engagement, and we have a variety of work groups and committees that advise us on our work. And Kathleen is a member of our equity advisory committee. And this idea first surfaced from our partners at UC Berkeley, UC San Francisco, Open House, pointing out that a similar survey had been conducted in Oregon on a smaller scale. And it was suggested that California should follow their suit. So as we do in California, we made it bigger and better. And we're just so proud that it's now underway. And most of all, we're excited to see the results and how we can put them into action.
Well, I appreciate that summary of the survey and the purpose and how it came together. And Kathleen, I wanted to go to you. So Open House serves older LGBTQ plus adults in the Bay Area. And so you see firsthand some of the unique challenges that they face. So can you talk about those and why you thought it was important to encourage the state to conduct the survey?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just say it's such a great opportunity to partner with the California Department of Aging. When we approached the California Department, I think it took 2 seconds for them to say, oh, yes, that's a great idea. We should probably do something like that. What we find at Open House, and we serve just over 3,000 LGBTQIA older adults in the Bay Area, is there are barriers to care and services. And what I mean by that is people have either fears based on past experiences with doctors, or they simply fear that they're going to be treated with substandard care. And that oftentimes causes people to not get the care that they need as early as they could. I think that as we look around and we look at aging for all Californians, we know there are some through lines, particularly around isolation, particularly for our frontier and rural community members. And what we wanted to find out were, what were some of the economic and social well-being issues that LGBTQ older adults in California who, you know, we've not asked those questions of, what are some of those issues? What are the cognitive or mental health issues that folks need help with? And then what are just the physical health issues? We find that comorbidity is very high in our community that we work with. But as we were talking to the Department of Aging, those are all anecdotal. That's anecdotal information. And the importance was, if we're going to understand on a statewide level, to just get a first baseline study on the aging of this group.
And Kathleen, I guess we should also just do some level setting here about what these initials stand for, why LGBTQ, which I think most people are familiar with, versus LGBTQIA+. Can you define those initials? I think some people may not be familiar with them, and why these groups are put together into this acronym.
Yeah, you know, we wanted to make sure that we were inclusive in this survey. We also had the survey translated into English, Tagalog, Spanish, and Cantonese, or formal Chinese. LGBTQIA+ is lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, intersex, and asexual. And so we put all these folks into one community, but the reality is we're many communities that make up one larger community.
And is there, besides the anecdotes maybe that you've, or the certain sort of individual stories you're aware of without the lack of this data that the survey is trying to get to, is there a reason why we would see different health outcomes with this community versus the non-version of that community?
Sure. Yeah, I think if you look, particularly if we look at our transgender elders, many have not had housing that has been stable, haven't had access to stable health care. And oftentimes folks in our community, particularly long-term survivors of HIV, for instance, have an enormous amount of mental health issues just around the crisis of losing their support network very early in their lives. And as they're aging, losing that support network again as people are passing or no longer able to connect with a community. We did do a study at Open House. This is just of San Francisco LGBT older adults in or during the pandemic. And we found that transgender and HIV long-term survivors had higher rates of depression and higher rates of suicidation than they did pre-pandemic. And so we're just seeing a through line, particularly around mental health needs for this community, that there is just a great need. As a matter of fact, my organization started providing mental health services about a year and a half ago because the need was so great.
And Susan, let me turn to you. Can you give us some examples of questions that the survey is asking? What kind of information are you hoping to get from the survey?
Sure. So we helped. We're so fortunate that we have partners. One of the key tenets of the master plan for aging is it's a whole of government, whole of society response. So we had a lot of input from community members, stakeholders, academic partners, and developing the right survey instrument. We're really focused on tangibles. So questions about healthcare, as you just heard, behavioral health, housing, income, caregiving, food assistance, and the really concrete programs and services that people need as they get older, transportation, informal supports. That's something with the LGBTQIA plus community nationwide, there's a strong reliance on informal family members providing long-term care. So, you know, to what extent is that available in this community? Unpaid family and friend supports as compared to paid caregiving that somebody might hire into their home. So those are the types of questions that we ask.
And Susan, do you have any early returns yet? I know the survey's still out, I believe, but any early indication, or is that not yet something you can talk about or have seen?
You know, at this point, with just under a week remaining, all that I can share is that we've had an overwhelmingly positive response. This really affirms for us that this is the right direction for California, that it was past time to do a baseline statewide survey. our academic partners were hoping we could receive 2,000 responses to be statistically valid. And as of today, we've had about 4,200, so more than double what we were hoping to receive. And with, you know, with the survey open until the 31st, we expect to have even more. With tonight's show, we hope listeners will participate and make their opinions and perspectives and experiences known to us too.
Absolutely. Well, it almost feels like election night where we don't want to call any races too soon. We want people to go to the polls, so we definitely want people to go to the survey and fill that out if they haven't already. Kathleen, I wanted to ask you about how you would see the needs of the LGBTQ plus population changing as they grow older. What have you seen in both your work at Open House, and what are you sort of expecting to see as part of the survey results, if you have any expectations along those lines?
You know, I think that what we have seen at Open House is that, you know, our community, like all communities, is aging. Still 10,000 people, 10,000 citizens a day are turning 65 or older. And so there's a large cohort of LGBTQI older adults that are aging as well. And I think what we've noticed is an increased need for care. Oftentimes, as Susan was saying, people don't have blood relations that will provide that care. We have families of choice that are providing that care, but that isn't always true for our community members. And so what we found is we've really needed to enhance and develop partnerships like with OnLock to actually provide on-site community day program services for older adults who now have, you know, some form of dementia, have severe mobility issues or other comorbidities that is causing them to be isolated. So we don't know yet, as Susan said, but I would anticipate what we're going to be seeing is a dramatic increase in the need, particularly for in-home care for this community of older adults.
Well, that certainly makes sense. We'll have to see what happens with those survey results. I'd want to let listeners know this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing a statewide survey designed to shed light on the needs of the LGBTQ community as they age. Very pleased to be joined by Susan DeMoris, Director of the California Department of Aging, and Kathleen Sullivan, Executive Director of Open House, a center serving LGBTQ seniors here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And if you're a member, an aging member of this community, we really would love to hear from you. What struggles have you had? What services or support would you like to see? Or if you're caring for an elder LGBTQIA plus person, what might be helpful to you? We want to hear your stories. You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, we have a few listener comments and questions here. One listener writes in, I want to thank your guests for putting out this survey. My partner and I are both in our 60s and have been anxious about what the future holds. I appreciate that the state is trying to gather information, and I especially appreciated the list of resources that was included at the end of the survey. And we have a link to the survey on the show page here, but Susan, maybe you want to speak to those resources that are at the end of the survey and what was the thought about how to put that list together?
Sure. And thanks for that comment. And it was the wisdom of our advisors to include the resources at the end of the survey. That doesn't always happen. And something with 1 in 4 Californians soon to be age 60 or older by the year 2030, we find that many Californians aren't aware or familiar with the services that are available to them in their local communities. Services like area agencies on aging, caregiver resource centers, adult day health care programs. We really want to emphasize the programs and supports that are available to help people live independently with dignity in their homes and stay actively engaged in their communities. For so long, there has been a focus on institutional settings, hospitals and nursing facilities, and it's very important to counter that with information and resources that will help people live independently at home.
And speaking of those resources, Susan, I wanted to stay with you. What is the role of the state in aiding this population? How do you see, you know, obviously your department within the state government, but just the broader governmental apparatus? What do you see as that role?
We have an important role to play, a critical role. And as I mentioned, you know, with one in four Californians soon to be 60 or older, and the fastest growing demographic of all in our state is the 85 plus population. We're laser focused, and we have Governor Newsom to thank for the master plan for aging that really hones in on the wide range of issues and needs and concerns of older Californians and their families and friends, housing, healthcare, caregiving. At the center of our master plan for aging is equity. And then how do we afford aging in a state like California, where housing is expensive, the out-of-pocket costs for medications, utilities, transportation. So how do we help older adults afford aging? We've done a number of things through the state Medi-Cal program. We've eliminated the asset test. We've expanded Medi-Cal coverage to all undocumented Californians. We've expanded CalFresh, which is a nutrition program, really doing all that we can to make it more affordable to live here in California through all our years, all ages and life stages.
Mm-hmm. And Kathleen, I know that previous studies have shown that LGBTQ plus adults living in California often face significant barriers accessing healthcare, despite having similar or better rates of insurance coverage compared to heterosexual or cisgender adults. If you find that the survey results reinforces this dynamic, what kind of interventions would you want to see to address this?
You know, I think that it's, you know, time will tell, but I do think that what we're focused on as part of our mission is also to train providers of care and services so that, you know, someone might have access, for instance, to healthcare, but if they don't access it because they feel as if it's not going to be a welcoming and accepting environment, then they're less likely to actually access that care. And as we age, we do have things that need to be checked out on a yearly basis. You know, that need to belong or that feeling of belonging and feeling safe is really critical to all care and services. So it is going to be interesting. You know, in Oregon, I was part of the study there. What they found was rural and frontier Oregonians had one or two people, who actually knew that they were LGBTQ. And those were the only people they were safe with. So on the one hand, it's good that they had someone that they were out to, that they could disclose their sexual orientation to. But at the same time, many people, particularly the HIV community in those areas, were driving 300 miles or 400 miles to go get healthcare because they didn't feel comfortable getting that care locally. So we don't know what our survey is going to tell us here. It's also really important to realize that we put an enormous amount of emphasis, and the California Department of Aging has been such a great partner in helping to make sure that we oversample the BIPOC, the API, rural and frontier communities, as well as the transgender community, because they're the least represented of all people within the LGBTQI community itself.
Well, and on this topic of healthcare, we have a listener who asks, what is the relationship, if any, between the ACA, Affordable Care Act, and the community that we're discussing tonight? Are they able to access care through the ACA? And I suppose, Susan, I should direct that to you, unless, Kathleen, you want to weigh in as well. But, Susan, I'll start with you.
All right, I'll take an attempt at that. I think we just celebrated the anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, and California has been a leader since inception, you know, lowering barriers to discriminate against prior conditions has been, you know, very, very important in allowing people to gain access to commercial health insurance to covered California. With the older adult population, many members of, 65 and older would rely on Medicare potentially, and possibly Medi-Cal. They might be dually eligible for Medi-Cal and Medicare. So less reliance on commercial insurance products as people get older. But certainly looking at behavioral health coverage in Medicare and Medi-Cal, making sure that people have access to mental health services, substance use disorder services. And Kathleen, you want to elaborate from your experience on the ground?
Yeah, thanks, Susan. What we find is that many of our community members are dual eligible or are not yet actually old enough to have Medicare. So they're on Medi-Cal. And that can be a lifeline and is a lifeline for many folks in our community. I would say one thing, though, that is still challenging to many, particularly of our transgender elders, is just simply not feeling comfortable or that there's clinical competence in providing high level of care for them. So it's still something that we're working on. And we have a training program that actually the California Department of Aging helped us to create that's really looking to create more safe spaces in the medical field for LGBTQ elders.
And if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and tonight we're discussing a survey designed to shed light on the needs of the LGBTQIA plus community as they age. We're very pleased to be joined by Susan DeMoris, who is director of the California Department of Aging, and Kathleen Sullivan, executive director of Open House, a center serving LGBTQ seniors in the Bay Area. And you can join us anytime by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We have another listener email who writes in, can your guests share ideas or resources for finding senior living arrangements that are LGBTQ friendly? And I think, Kathleen, this is a good one for you to take.
Yeah. It depends really what you're looking for and quite frankly, what you're eligible for. Open House has two buildings of affordable housing that are open and welcoming to LGBT older adults. And soon we'll have a third. All three will be in San Francisco. There are also some communities in different parts of our state. In Los Angeles, there's both Triangle Square and the Arundine Getty affordable housing building. And I was actually just at not affordable housing, but market rate housing in Palm Springs called Living Out, which is independent living as well. There isn't an enormous amount of housing that is available specifically created to be open and welcoming and affirming for LGBTQ older adults. However, there are many communities that have been trained, and that are welcoming. And I believe, if someone is interested, they can go on sageusa.org. That's sageusa.org. They're a national organization, and they have a fairly decent list, which is national. So you can actually pick out the state where you're living in and see what might be available within your state.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. And we have a caller, Jim from San Francisco. Jim, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hello. I've been taking care of somebody that has dementia and Alzheimer's for the last 2 years, and I had to put him into a assisted living place, and it's really hard to find something affordable. His is paying $5,000 a month, which is not easy for most people. And there's not too many places around for this. So, and there's going to be a lot of dementia patients coming up through the pipeline. And how are we going to deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, I appreciate you calling in, and I'm sorry you're dealing with that. Let's see, Susan, do you want to respond to Jim's comment and situation here?
Sure. Jim, thank you for calling in. And my heart goes out to you. And I can appreciate how difficult that decision must have been. And then when you face choices that aren't affordable and the financial stress on top of caregiving stress, which doesn't end when somebody is living in assisted living, it continues. So, assisted living is a very popular level of care that has really grown in our state and nationwide. More of a home-like environment, less institutional, and as in your experience, more focused on Alzheimer's, dementia, and memory care with specialized staff and training and a more conducive environment. A few things that the state is doing. We have a Medi-Cal assisted living waiver in our state. So individuals in the most populous counties can access, if they're eligible for Medi-Cal, they'd be able to access assisted living that would be paid for by the state Medi-Cal program. For individuals who are not on Medi-Cal, this is a level of care that is paid for out of pocket, unless somebody had the foresight to access long-term care insurance earlier in their lives. But today, long-term care insurance policies are not widely available. Kathleen, you might have some unique insights in the Bay Area about what you're seeing and hearing.
Yeah, you know, it is part of the reason that we created a partnership with OnLock is that they created something called PACE, which is the Program for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly. And PACE is a wonderful program that helps folks even with dementia. So not folks who are end stage Alzheimer's or dementia, but folks who can still live in community to provide the medical care, transportation, meals, socialization. And our program with them is a community day service center. We call it Club 75 because no one wants to go to community day. They want to go to the club. And that is a concern for open house because all of our housing is independent housing and we want to keep people in place living in community for as long as possible. Mm-hmm. So we co-sited this community day services program, which is an alternative healthcare setting, with OnLock in the hopes that we could actually help to funnel some of our community members through into the PACE program. Mm-hmm. Assisted living, particularly for the community that we predominantly work with, is almost, it is true that Medi-Cal can now pay for assisted living, but we found it very challenging to actually find beds or room in those facilities for folks who are very low income and who would need to access that Medi-Cal reimbursement. So I'm not sure that we have, Jim, the exact answer yet. And I think part of that is due to the age wave. We have so many more people that are aging. The director noted the fact that the fastest growing segment of our population in California are people 85 and older. So this is something new. I think that we're fortunate that we're actually moving in the right direction with the master plan on aging and having folks that are really looking at how do we problem solve to either keep people in the community for as long as they can or in affordable.
Well, unfortunately, we're just out of time here. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I'm sorry to have to cut it off, but it's been great to learn about the survey, which we have posted on our website. We do encourage listeners who fit this demographic to fill it out. But I just want to thank you both, Susan DeMoris, Director of the California Department of Aging, and Kathleen Sullivan, Executive Director of Open House. Thank you both so much for coming on State of the Bay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ethan.
And I want to let listeners know this segment was produced with the support of a Journalist and Aging Fellowship from the Journalist Network on Generations, the Gerontological Society of America, and the Artstone Foundation. Coming up after this break, my co-host Grace Wan will introduce you to Allegra Madsen, the new executive director of the largest LGBTQ+ film festival in the world. We'll be right back.
On the Next Door Call, we'll rebroadcast our discussion about the new Human Rights Watch report, We're Dying Here, The Fight for Life in a Louisiana Fossil Fuel Sacrifice Zone. It documents how residents of Cancer Alley suffer the effects of extreme pollution from the fossil fuel and petrochemical industry. They face elevated rates and risks of maternal, reproductive, and newborn health harms and cancer. Join the Next Door Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
And that'll be a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call, and that's happening tonight at 7 o'clock here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Grace Wan with another installment in our series, Have You Met? These interviews feature people from around the Bay who we think you should get to know. Tonight, we're introducing you to Allegra Madsen. She's the new executive director of the Frameline Film Festival. Frameline is the longest-running, largest, and most widely recognized LGBTQ+ film exhibition in the world. Allegra, welcome to State of the Bay.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to ask you, how did you get into the film world?
You know, I kind of took a circuitous route. My background is in fine art and contemporary art curating, but I was always interested in how to use art as a community building platform. And I always felt that film was, I always call it like the gateway art form. It's an art form that people understand how to interact with. And because of that, it's easier for a film to touch people and create empathy and create kind of connections. And so I would always want to have a film program that was paired with maybe a more difficult to access art form.
You were part of Frameline before you took this position as executive director. What does Frameline mean to you?
So I was the director of programming for 3 years. It is really kind of amazing to me. I feel like people aren't quite as familiar with what a film festival can be and do. Frameline in particular brings the entire queer cinematic cultural production world to San Francisco for 11 days. So you can go and see as many experiences of being queer from around the world as you can fit into a day.
And you're the programming person for the film festival for a long time. How are films chosen for the festival?
My goal is always to be an accurate reflection of queer cultural production on as wide a scale as I possibly can. So it is a lot of me and my team just scouring the world looking for what's being made. It's a lot of investigative work. It's a lot of chasing people and like, I heard about this thing. Can you bring it to the festival? Then there's also a submission process where filmmakers can submit their films to us. And we have a team of folks that watch every single film that comes our way. And, you know, it's a curatorial process. We weigh one against the other, see what themes and tracks are coming up, and we try to pull the best.
What's your vision for what Frameline can be and will be?
Frameline is an amazing festival. That is our crown jewel, but we aren't just that. I want us to take queer film from ideation all the way to restoration. And we kind of have pieces of this going already. We have a completion fund that helps folks get their film projects over that final hurdle of, you know, final sound mixing or whatever. Then we do the exhibition with the festival. And then we have a distribution arm, which makes sure the stories are made, aren't lost, that there's a hub for them and they can still be found out in the world. And we also have a restoration arm to make sure that films don't just sit in a closet somewhere and not keep up with the times.
I'm just curious. I mean, I've been to one of the Frameline Film Festivals in the past, but for listeners who haven't, are there any particular films that broke at Frameline that they might know about?
We're going to show the new restoration of Go Fish, which is the like new queer cinema classic from the 90s that premiered here. Last year, Fairyland premiered here. It was a very Bay Area focused film produced by Sofia Coppola. Lots of films.
Is there a particular Bay Area look and feel that you kind of look for when you program the festival?
I always want to highlight Bay Area work, because in the Bay in general is an amazing film community. And so I always want to highlight film work. And then I think in the overall structure of the festival, I want to make it a very Bay feeling thing. And I think that comes with like our connection to community, making sure that the right audiences are in front of the right films and making sure that all the talent and everyone is accessible and mingling with everyone. Because I think that's what's special about the Bay is like, we're just all in it together.
I think one thing that films are facing, I mean, people are watching films and media content more than ever, thanks to streaming services, but so many people opt not to go to the theater. They choose to watch the film on their phones or from their couch. How are you trying to encourage people to come back to the theater to experience the films?
I mean, look, I like to watch films at home on my couch as much as the next person. But it is a different experience to do it in a theater. And I think that is the way that you experience art. At home, I experience TV content. You know, it just comes to me. But if I want to have an experience with art where I'm communicating, I'm a part of the film, basically. I'm giving of myself and my time in a dark room, completely immersed in the film. I think it's just a different thing. And I really hope that people don't lose track of that just because of the ease. Also, you know, it's a risk. And I think risk is fun. Like, it's a risk to go out to see a film at a film festival that you might not know anything about. And it's a beautiful risk when it pays off and you see something that you couldn't access on your TV at home.
Well, I think there's too a matter of trust and this idea that you all have, as you said, scoured the world to look for great films, and there's a curatorial process and a kind of a threshold that you need to meet. So, you know, maybe a film festival is the exact right place to experience a film because people who know about film have said, hey, this is worth looking at. This is worth experiencing. Is that something that you think about when you program?
Absolutely. I always make that pitch at the beginning of the festival. Like, you have to trust me. You know, you can read about it and you can look at the picture, but really you're just going to have to trust me that this is here for a reason and you should see it.
Yeah, and see it in the theater. I'm curious if digital filmmaking has helped open up the medium for new and perhaps less well-funded filmmakers. I'm not sure if it's cheaper to make a digital film, but it has technology helped bring other voices that you might not normally have been able to get?
Certainly. I mean, film is always expensive. It is an expensive medium, and it is essentially every film is a small business. It just is. The size of the team that you have to pull together, the actors behind the camera, the producers, you're creating with every film a small business. So it is very helpful. Digital production is cheaper than, say, shooting on film. It does help, but it's still an expensive labor of love.
Mm-hmm. This is not just people shooting on their iPhones.
Not yet.
So tell us a little bit about the upcoming festival. What are the themes and what should we be looking out for?
We're still very much in the programming process. The upcoming festival, our dates are going to be June 19th through the 29th. We are really excited about kicking this festival off on Wednesday, June 19th, which is now the federal Juneteenth holiday. We do have something in store for that coming up, but I'll just have to tease it a little bit.
Okay. I mean, I like that. And if I want to find out more about the festival, where can I go?
You can always find us at frameline.org. And really the place to like really communicate with us is on Instagram, where you can find us at framelinefest.
And if somebody wants to break into the festival, wants to, you know, get in touch and say like, hey, I have a film, how does a person do that?
You can find on our website through our submission portal, and there's also our completion fund, which will open up rather shortly. I also say, you know, if you've made a film, just email people. I see these things come in, and you start to get some sort of name recognition. I'd also say if you're interested in the film festival world, contact us. We have a lot of volunteer positions, and that's really how people start working their way up and like becoming a part of the community.
Well, finally, Frameline is hoping to draw new filmmakers through its Youth in Motion program. Tell us a little bit about that and how you can get involved.
So Youth in Motion is every year we select a cohort of films that we develop a curriculum for, and then we work with national high schools to get folks watching a movie together and discussing it and looking at the topics and looking at the queer perspectives brought up by the film.
Well, Allegra, it's been so nice to meet you. Thank you for being on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much. It's been great to meet you as well.
We were talking with Allegra Madsen. She's the new executive director of the Frameline Film Festival. Frameline's the longest running and largest and most widely recognized LGBTQ+ film exhibition in the world. Listeners, is there someone you think we should meet? Write to us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or leave us a voicemail at 866-798-8255. You might hear the voice of someone you know on our next show.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week, and you just heard my co-host Grace Wan. We hope you'll join us again next Monday at 6 when Grace sits down for a one-on-one with San Francisco mayoral candidate Mark Farrell. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen and never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our State of the Bay page on klw.org. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, you can let us know. Email us anytime at stateofthebay@klw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney and Katie Colley. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. A replay of today's Your Call is coming up next. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.